Before science and the arts got put into different boxes, musicians mapped the stars and chemists wrote romantic poetry. In a book called The Age of Wonder, Richard Holmes, a biographer of Shelley and Coleridge, turned his attention to these other Romantic era figures, the men and women who made great scientific discoveries in 18th century Britain in what he calls the Second Scientific Revolution. The book was a national bestseller when it was published in hardcover last year, and now The Age of Wonder is available in a paperback edition from Vintage Books. I'm very pleased that it brings Richard Holmes to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
The Age of Wonder, as I said, was a national bestseller and one of the New York Times Book Review's top 10 books of the year in 2009. Were you surprised by the amount of attention it got in this country?
Yeah, there was some change over from my readership with writing about literary things to suddenly science produced something else. And certainly in America, yes. I like to feel it's been well understood over here.
Well, it's interesting that this area, this period of discovery has been written about a lot, but never in the context that I know of the Romantic era.
No, I started out, I think most people think that the Romantic writers all hated science. The poets hated science, and they never talked to the scientists. And I spent a long time gradually researching this book, beginning with a friendship between the poet Coleridge and the chemist Humphry Davy. That's where it all began, and that was about 10 years ago.
Well, Coleridge, of course, was involved in a certain kind of personal chemistry, which caused him a lot of trouble.
Yes, you're right.
His problems with drugs. But would that have been totally separate from his relationship to Davy?
Not at all. Davy, just sketch in the background there, very young man from Cornwall, that's the west of England. And when he was 20, he was put in charge of a new laboratory in Bristol. That's the seacoast there, the big port station there in Bristol, where they were experimenting with new gases because they discovered the air wasn't just the air, it was made up of all kinds of what they call artificial airs. And he was isolating the gases, hydrogen being one, we'll come back to that maybe. But he was working on nitrous oxide, which we know as laughing gas. Mm-hmm. And in a quite modern way, he wanted to see. He believed that by inhaling laughing gas, you could cure the great scourge of the air of the area, which was tuberculosis.
Wasn't he the person who discovered that plants take in carbon dioxide and produce oxygen?
Yes, and some of his later papers, he did that carbon cycle. He defines it very well. That was a little bit later. Here he's still, it's very young, working on this. And he brings in various volunteers, and he's going to test the effects of the gas. And one of the volunteers is the young Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And I have to tell you, probably a year after he wrote the great Kublai Khan opium poem. So a year later, he's inhaling nitrous oxide. And
so he's looking for any kind of high he can get?
Well, the amazing thing is that Coleridge's notes on his experience under nitrous oxide are very prosaic and sober. They're not at all poetical. And the poetical one was the chemist Davy, who actually wrote a series of poems under the gas to see what effect it had on his mind. So you imagine these two chaps, both in their 20s, okay, the enormous excitement. They thought maybe they were going to produce something which would benefit the entire mankind by dealing with the scourge of tuberculosis. What they found was this euphoric gas. And then Davy, it's very interesting, he realized the gas had anesthetic properties, that it could stop pain, because he took it with a toothache at one moment. And he wrote a scientific paper proposing the notion of anesthesia in surgery.
Did anybody use that during the Napoleonic War?
Very good question. He published, and he never followed up the research. He went to London. I look in the book. There's a romantic reason why he didn't follow up, because he fell in love with his boss's wife, a wonderful young woman called Anna Bedders. And he felt he had to leave the institution or he would bring it into disrepute. So he went to London. Meanwhile, Coleridge stayed friends with him. And there are a wonderful series of letters they exchange on the notion of pain. Why should we feel pain? What's the function of pain? Couldn't you have pain-free surgery? Why was there pain in childbirth? It's a very series of radical discussions of this. So that is the beginnings of a crossover between a literary writer and a scientist, and that friendship goes throughout their life.
Davy also is remembered for developing a safe lamp for miners.
Yeah.
So he's all over the place. Or yeah. Is it all connected to the same basic research?
It is, because if you think for a moment, it's all to do with gases. The nitrous oxide was an artificial gas. The miner's lamp was based on isolating the nature of methane gas, which came out of the deep pit mine shafts, was producing terrible explosions. 90, 100 people were being killed at a time. They brought Davy in up to the north of England. He went down the mines. He took samples of the gas, took it back to his laboratory, and analyzed it all over Christmas 1815-16. And he had a young assistant there. His name was Michael Faraday, who would become the great next generation scientist. And I'm able to follow that through. It's very exciting how they're quite dangerous. And he finally comes up with this wonderful, simple invention, which is a lamp that doesn't have to be, have glass on it, doesn't have to be airtight. It just has to have an iron kind of a grid or foil around it. And that prevents the flame, the naked flame, lighting the gas outside. It won't go through that metal gauze. It's an experiment we used to do as children. You hold over a piece of gauze over a Bunsen burner, and the flame won't go through. So that was very exciting. I may also say that Davy's wife was furious with him because he wouldn't come home for Christmas.
My guest is Richard Holmes, whose book The Age of Wonder is now available in paperback from Vintage. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about what you called the second scientific revolution. The first one, a bit more professional. This one, more amateur?
No, I wouldn't. The first one, I think, which is much more known about, it's at the time of the formation of the Royal Society in London and the French Academy of Science. And it's associated with, in France, with people like Descartes, and over in England, Newton, Hooke, Robert Boyle, that group.
But those are more traditional scientists,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, and that is the kind of the first scientific revolution.
And better educated, generally.
Interesting question, that. They were gentlemen scientists. They were a lot, Newton, for instance, based at Cambridge, Trinity College, Cambridge. Their papers were all in Latin, not in English. So it was for a very small elite. And what happens in my second scientific revolution? Suddenly, no, public lectures, papers published in English. In fact, Davy's paper on how he invented the safety lamp, which is called something like Some Effects of Flame, is a beautiful bit of prose writing. It's five little essays following the course of the experiment. So suddenly it was open, and big public lectures were given.
So anyone who could read would be aware that this was going on.
Yes.
And might be inspired to try his or her hand at doing something on his or her own.
Yeah, that's how the young Michael Faraday joined Davy, because he read a popular book written for girls by a woman called Jane Marcet about chemistry. He was a young bookbinder. He bound the book, and he read it as he bound it, and he immediately went along to Davy's lectures and joined.
Was this enthusiasm for science something that was happening all over Europe, or was it mainly based in England?
It was happening all over Europe, but this is, of course, the time of Napoleonic Wars, and to some extent that shuts down scientific experiment, not entirely, and not in medicine, for example. But in England, it's happening in astronomy, in chemistry, in surgery, in exploration as well. People are beginning to go round the world.
Well, was there an awareness of what was going on scientifically in France? For example, one of the outcomes of the French Revolution is the metric system. There was an attempt to come up with a more scientific calendar and a more scientific clock. Those things failed, but the metric system is now...
Absolutely.
Is now the system of science.
And it's still there.
Everywhere but in the United States.
Well, yes, and in England, I mean, you come over here and you take the temperature. Is it 60 degrees or is it 20 degrees? You know, which is it? That, in fact, is very interesting. This is a terrific rivalry between the scientists in France and Great Britain. And in a way, that drove the science. I'll give you one example. We're talking about gases, all right? One of the gases discovered was hydrogen, which is lighter than air. And very quickly, people discover that you can fill a lightweight container and you've got a balloon, and then this balloon is man-carrying. It's got capacities. So there was a balloon race. The French, Montgolfier, using hot air initially and then gases, and the Brits also doing it. And there, it became a race who would first fly a balloon across the Channel. And it was also a form of arms race. Benjamin Franklin was in Paris, very shrewd, American ambassador there. He was writing secret letters back to the Royal Society, describing these balloons and saying, watch it, because if you can put one man up in a balloon, you can put an army up in a balloon. And it depends on which way is the wind blowing.
And Franklin is credited in this country with being one of our first great scientific minds. But did the British think at the beginning anyway that ballooning was some kind of inferior French occupation?
Yes, that's quite funny. The Royal Society thought it was a typical piece of French excitement. But it was Franklin who said, pay attention to this. And in fact, in a rather characteristic way, all the British experiments, they were not funded by the government. They were independent. And there was a great race, particularly to cross the Channel. And there was a balloon in Calais on the French side and another one in Dover on the English side.
And there was another American involved, an American doctor in London named Dr. John Jeffreys.
That's right. And the winning balloon, which was a British balloon, which went over from Dover, was actually piloted by two men, one whose name was Jean-Pierre Blanchard, who was French, and the other was Dr. John Jeffreys, who was American. And that was the British balloon.
You describe many amusing anecdotes about ballooning, women having amorous encounters with French soldiers, balloons going off course. Were they seen as a danger?
Yes, and they were also seen as, yes, quite suggestive. And the Mile High Club probably began in a balloon, you have to say. yes, and they...
But they didn't go a mile.
Yes, they did.
They did.
Oh, yes. Yes, by 1804, they were going up to 27,000 feet. Absolutely staggering.
So they were also being used for scientific reasons.
Yes.
To check out the weather and also to map. As an undergraduate at Oxford in 1811, you say, the poet Shelley, somebody you've written about in the mm-hmm. past, said balloons might be used to map Africa.
That's right.
And he also saw it as a way of eliminating slavery.
That's right. There would be radical freedom would come from balloons. Very interesting because... meteorology really begins with ballooning. What's happening in the upper air? What is a barometer really measuring? What's happening in cloud structures? Initially, people thought if you flew into a cloud, you'd be electrocuted. Okay, so you're having the beginnings of weather, cloud description, Luke Howard, the modification of clouds. But also, yes, what Shelley saw, and he wrote one wonderful poems about this, that somehow the balloon would free people because you could float right across Africa, you could discover, you could explore, and you could bring help with balloons. And I suppose the other thing is you looked downwards from a balloon and you saw the earth quite differently. You saw the effect of cities on the countryside. And I compare it in the book to that amazing moment in 1968, Apollo 8. They take the photograph, Earthrise, which is the beautiful blue planet rising above the dead ground of the moon. Now, that changed, didn't it? There's an argument for saying the environmental movement began that image of the planet Earth. In the same way, back in the 1780s, that the visions of the Earth from a balloon, and they painted it, and they mapped it, and they saw the weather affecting it, the rivers, that changed, and it fed into the whole romantic idea of what nature is.
It also, we also link Shelley with Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. And this is, I don't know if it's the first science fiction story, but it has to be up there.
Yes, I think arguably it is. There were some French versions, but I think the very interesting thing there is that, first of all, it's everybody thought that this book, which you remember is the man, Dr. Victor Frankenstein, who I describe as one of the leading bioengineers of his time, but imaginary, of course.
But seen in a positive way.
Yes, presented. And also that Mary Shelley had been to lectures by Humphrey Davy, again our chemist, and she'd read accounts of actual operations which took place, an Italian surgeon working in London called Aldini, who got permission to have the body of an executed criminal brought to a laboratory in public and put electrical generating equipment on the body and try and revive it.
They called it vitalism.
Then a whole theory rose from this and a great argument, vitalism, what's the human soul, what's the human consciousness, what's the force?
Although we do something like that even today. If somebody has had a heart attack, we apply electrodes.
Somebody was saying a defibrillator, what would Mary Shelley have thought of that? She would have been very pleased.
Well, maybe she is the inventor in some ways. We have to take a little break. We'll be back with more from Richard Holmes, whose book, The Age of Wonder, was a national bestseller when it was published in hardcover by Pantheon last year, and now available in paperback from Vintage. We are back with Richard Holmes, who has written biographies of romantic poets, among other things, and now has written about the romantic era scientists, some of them poets as well, in a book called The Age of Wonder. It is now available in paperback from Vintage. Do you think that before he went mad, King George III's keen interest in science played a role in all of this happening?
Yes, it did. And you're quite right. Everybody thinks of him, oh, the king who went mad. But in fact, he was absolutely fascinated by science. If anybody goes to the British Library in London now, you walk straight in and you will see six floors of books in a glass central core, which are George III's gift to the nation. He was particularly interested in astronomy, whereby hangs a tale from this book, because one of the breakthroughs was made by William Herschel, who was, like George III, in German background, came from Hanover.
And Wilhelm Herschel, originally?
Yes, the spelling of his name is very interesting. It changes as he gradually becomes anglicized. He insisted always on writing and talking in English. Very interesting, the moment he came over. He was a trained musician, a composer, taught music. But then he was an amateur astronomer on the side, and gradually the hobby took over the profession. And he started building his own telescopes. He moved to Bath. And then he brought his young sister, Caroline, who's a very important person in the book. She's the kind of heroine of the book. She was stuck back home in Hanover, and she was being bullied by her parents. They wouldn't let her have any education, no arithmetic, no languages. The moment she was 21, William went back over to Hanover, almost kidnapped her, brought her back to England, started her on a musical career, and she got interested in astronomy, and they became this amazing astronomy team.
Did it help that Herschel was a musician? Is the mapping of the stars similar to making musical notation?
Yeah, that's a very good point. There is something. He had a genius for sight reading, and there is something between sight reading music and sight reading the universe. And he also, in his later letters, he built all his telescopes, and he describes them like musical instruments, that they need tuning, you need to learn to use them, you just put your eye to a telescope.
And his telescope was actually more powerful than the Astronomer Royals in Greenwich.
It was a wonderful series of telescopes, 7 foot, 10 foot, 20 foot, and 40 foot, and they were the biggest ones in Europe, and he discovered a new planet with them.
Did King George III help him fund all of this?
Yeah, the king was very excited by this, got him to bring the smaller telescope to the court at Windsor, and then funded him. He had a salary of £200 a year, which was a lot. And even more interesting, after a year or two, he also gave Caroline a salary, which was the first probably salary for a woman scientist ever.
And we know a lot about what happened through her diaries, but wasn't she the first astronomer to identify Halley's Comet?
Not Halley's Comet. That had been identified, indeed, by Halley a bit earlier. But you're absolutely right. She was a genius for finding comets, and she found 8 in her lifetime. And the really good comet finders had been the French astronomers. So the Royal Society in London were very pleased with her.
Now, what led Herschel to leave Hanover in the first place? Did he see England as a place that would be more welcoming to someone with his interests?
Yes, I think it's a story we very well understand now. It's the immigrant who comes, who's unhappy at home. For him, England was much more a freer place. He adopted it. He was very patriotic, passionate about it. As I say, when I was in the archives, the very first letter in the archives is in old German, and I thought, this is going to be troublesome. I turned the page. Everything else was in English.
Well, it's interesting how welcoming England was to other artists. After all, Holbein and Van Dyck, two of the greatest artists that ever lived, were emigre artists in England. Handel wrote most of his most important work in
England.
That's
right. And, for instance, Haydn. Haydn came over, Joseph Haydn, very interesting from Austria, and he actually goes and visits Herschel's observatory. He looks through the telescope. I've been able to show Herschel wasn't there. Caroline showed Haydn around. And 2 years later, he wrote the great oratorio called The Creation, And the first movement of that, anybody who knows, extraordinary passage before the universe has been created. And there's a generally accepted view now that in musical terms he was trying to show what Herschel had shown looking through his telescopes, the formation of the new constellations and galaxies.
Wasn't Herschel the first astronomer to discover a planet in over 1,000 years?
Yeah, that's right. Since Ptolemy, it was 13th of March, 1781, and he was using his 7-foot telescope, and it was the 7th planet out, counting from Mercury, including Earth, and it was one called Uranus, which is it's a gas planet. It spins on its side, and that made him famous. But it's not the only thing he did. He discovered that there were galaxies outside the Milky Way for the first time, and he changed our whole notion of the size of the universe.
Now, this book ends before Darwin, but we also are reminded about Darwin's journeys because a number of these scientists were involved in the age of exploration.
Yeah, I mean, the book begins with James Cook's first circumnavigation with the young botanist Joseph Banks on it, and it ends with the very young Charles Darwin heading out to the Galapagos Islands, to South America. That's in 1831. Those are the kind of two structures that bookend the work.
And Joseph Banks was a botanist. Why did he choose that as his area of expertise?
Banks, extraordinary man, with this very privileged education, Oxford and Harrow, and almost all his generation then went on the nice, safe, comfortable European tour. He didn't. He bought a position aboard Cook's boat, the Endeavour. He bought botanical equipment, and the transforming experience for him was they spent nearly 3 months on Tahiti, which I describe in the first chapter of the book.
And he thought he'd discovered paradise.
Well, he had a certain skepticism about it, but it really changed him from being a kind of cool European Enlightenment collector. He became what I describe as a romantic anthropologist. He learns the language, he learns all the rites. He makes great friends out there, and there's some very amusing things that happen to him. And he's a changed man when he comes back.
Well, Tahiti had already been described by the French as the new island of love.
That's right.
What did Banks think of it?
Yes, I think he had several amorous encounters there, but that was not the most significant thing. He took part in all the kind of, for instance, mourning rituals. He was allowed, when someone died, to take part in the ceremony of dancing the soul off the beach, which actually turns out to be a rather curious event because he has to do that naked, dancing with the other family members. But he also is involved with religious belief. He studies cookery, tattooing, and it's the first ever European account of surfing. Wonderful passage in his unpublished diaries describing what he thinks is Tahitians drowning, and then he realizes they're doing this thing called surfing, this pure pleasure. And from that, a little bit of metaphysics, he says their attitude to nature has got something to show us because they're not trying to conquer it. They're using it just in harmony with it for pure pleasure and skill. A wonderful passage.
Was he recording what was going on this expedition?
Yes, James Cook, his captains, those journals are very well known and well published. Amazingly, I mean, Banks kept 2,000 pages of Diary of the Endeavour journal, never properly published. It's been privately published.
What about, did they bring an artist along to record what they saw?
Yeah, best of all, he had this very young chap, 19-year-old Sidney Parkinson, who has done over 200 drawings. And it's very interesting. They start with botanical. And then as Banks gets interested in the Tahitians themselves, there are wonderful drawings of the families and the particular series of mother and child. And there's a tragedy here that Jan Sidney Parkinson, what most people forget about that voyage, it was so successful, but on the way back, when they got to Jakarta, 40% of the crew died from dysentery, and including young Parkinson and the two Tahitians they'd brought back with them.
Well, they had avoided scurvy, hadn't they?
Yes. Cook was James Cook, wonderful captain, navigation help. But the irony was it's the first time they put into a European-type port, and that was the moment they were struck down. Up to then, they'd lost nobody except one man who jumped overboard for interesting reasons.
Since Banks, his diaries were never published, were people aware of all of the things he had achieved?
Yes. I mean, they were published in Australia, so you can get them online. That's worth saying. You can get them online now.
I meant Would a young Darwin have been aware of what Banks had
done? Yes. Darwin, in fact, there's wonderful letters just before he leaves on the Galapagos expedition. He says he wants to do what Banks has done. This has been his great inspiration. So, yes, we should say that when Joseph Banks came back, after he settled down, after his Tahitian experience, he was elected president of the Royal Society, and he served in that position for 42 years. So he knew all the young scientists.
There's a debate even now with scientists and religious people, some scientists who are religious, some who are atheists, as to the relationship between science and religion and whether God plays any role in all of this. What was the thinking at the time?
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, the word scientist, for example, didn't exist until a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1833, and they said, we need a word. It was proposed scientist.
They weren't called scientists?
No, they were called natural philosophers, which was a bit of a mouthful.
And although science comes out of philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely, and it still does. So the word scientist was proposed, and a lot of people objected because it sounded too much like atheist. But broadly speaking, I mean, Banks was not a particularly religious man. Herschel was. It depended. I would say in general, for most of those science people, this did not affect their religious beliefs. But, and there is a but, there were people like young Shelley, for example, who, when he saw the new universe that Herschel had opened up with astronomy, wrote very fiery atheistical statements saying this universe is too big. It must have other civilizations in it. Christian religion, where does that fit? If there are other planets out there, and so on. So, in fact, there are the beginnings of a stirring which is going to move towards evolution and all the upset and changes that that will create.
Well, we mentioned that Shelley had imagined that balloons could be used to map Africa and in doing so would eliminate or annihilate slavery. How far had the Europeans traveled into the interior of Africa by the late 18th century?
Yeah, not very far, and they'd lost almost everybody who went out until this young, wiry Scotsman called Mungo Park.
Now, where did he get that name, Mungo?
Yes,
I've never seen that name.
You know, I know. There is a Saint Mungo. It's a Scottish saint, and his mother, who adored him, named him after the saint. And he's a very interesting character, tall, wiry, sandy-haired. He goes out and he tracks the course of the Niger River, two expeditions. He maps it, and he never comes back from the second one.
Do we know what happened?
Yeah, we do. The first one, it's an extraordinary story, and he wrote a wonderful book about it. He travels alone.
He goes to Timbuktu.
Yeah, he's heading for Timbuktu. He never quite makes it. He sees it in the distance. And he literally travels alone, and there's an amazing account on the way back. He's surrounded by bandits who take everything he's got except for his trousers and his hat. And in his hat, in the hat band inside, are all his travel journals. So he still gets back. But on the second time, very interesting, it's a more imperial expedition. He takes 40 troops with him, and they're attacked as they go down the river. And that's probably what happened. He was trying to go back on a raft, and he was attacked for, in a way, quite reasonable reasons, because he had not paid duty to the tribespeople of that particular area. So they regarded him as hostile. He would never have done that on the first expedition.
Didn't his son come to look for him some years later?
That's an extraordinary story. Somebody ought to write a novel about it.
Joseph Conrad may have.
Well, The Heart of Darkness is very close to, well done, very good comparison. That experience of going up river in the Heart of Darkness, which is the Congo, is amazingly similar to the Niger. And his son never believes his father was killed. He believed maybe he was captured, or maybe like a Conrad figure, he was turned into a local king in some way. So his son sets out. He never tells the family. He writes a note to his mother, a last note. He says, I'm going into the interior to find father. And he too disappears.
What happened? Why did science and the arts become separated?
I'm asked this question a lot. Something happens.
Because there have been attempts more recently to bring scientists and artists together, and we see it every so often, but in the end, I'm not sure that they'll ever be completely reconciled.
I disagree with you. I actually think this is now changing, and there are various forces changing this, educational forces, the internet itself. I think there was some aberration, and I put my finger, this famous lecture by the British scientist C.P. Snow, called The Two Cultures, which is 100 years after Darwin's book. It was in 1959. And I think that was a lot to do of science and the war, nuclear weapons. I think all that created a kind of split. And I think now everybody is trying to close that split.
Didn't C.P. Snow write novels?
Yes, he did. He did all about university life. But the lecture was the thing he's remembered for.
Richard Holmes will be speaking with Paul Holden-Graeber tomorrow night at 7 o'clock for more information. That's at the New York Public Library, right?
That's right.
For more information and tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book is called The Age of Wonder. It is now published by Vintage. It was originally published by Pantheon and became a national bestseller, and also was deemed by the New York Times to be one of the best books of the year 2009. What happens now for you?
Well, I'm going to get back in a balloon and float around. I do have some ideas, but steadily, slowly.
Back to artists, poets, or scientists?
No, I'll keep that bridge across between the two, very much so.
And I thank you so much for being with us today, Richard Holmes.
It's been a great pleasure.